As the Yeshiva's alumni guy, I'll tell you that there are many alumni, and they come in all different forms. And some spent various different amounts of time in the Yeshiva. And there's some who were less affiliated with the Yeshiva and still would like to consider themselves an alumni. We had just a program now of Shavu Banim. Shavu Banim is the South African Australians Come Back for the Summer program. And a non-alumnus, said, "Can I please join that program? Everybody else is coming back to the Yeshiva for 2 weeks to learn in the summer. I never did. Can I just come?" And he had such a great time, and he wrote to me and he said, "Please add me to the alumni list. I'll come to the events. Send me the emails. I want part of this." And of course, b'simcha. And various different ones. There's another sort of alumnus. We're very happy to have aboard. Rabbi Maybrook has an aunt who lives in Alonshfoot. You pass her house all the time. She's the first house next to the old gate. Okay? And of course, when he came to Israel, hung out at his aunt's house. And what else is there to do in Alonshfoot? Come to the base medrash to learn. And he came and he heard Shiurim and met Rav Lichtenstein. And he said, "Okay, I'm an alumnus. I've learned much time in the yeshiva, and we're glad to have you aboard. And we're jealous of the work you do, helping so many people, Klal Yisrael, marriage counseling and premarital counseling, and the work you did at YU as a mashgiach and founding the Shenk Shul, and everything you do. And I recommend, in addition to what Rabbi Maybrook's going to say today, a few years ago we had Rabbi Maybrook come speak about self-confidence. That's on the Yeshiva's YouTube channel. You could find it. Today we asked him to talk about peer pressure. Very, very important topic. And without further ado, please, Rabbi Maybrook. Mike, sitting mic, standing mic. What's comfortable for you?
How about you? Thank you, Ray Friedman. It's my supposed to be here. I learned for a full Elsman by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And sometimes, even Gadol Mishimusho, Gadol Shimusho, Yosim Limudo. I remember somewhat of the, I'm curious about Eidus, Rav Aaron taught me when we were doing the middle of Jitin, you're dying to your tests.
No learning this year.
I don't believe it. Really? Wow. I believe that. Wow. Remember Aaron talking about when Adam went to Acapulco, I remember his whole surah talking about the different ways that Adam had to Zayif Adam. But Rav Aaron looked at him as a person who was Ha'ud Avra, Mr. Finamine, a person who personified all the positive things we're going to talk about in today's discussion. A person who made an indelible mark on me, not just for a person at Shifa, for Gadlus in Torah, but who personified Yerush Shemayim, sincerity, Anava. So in many ways, although the discussion we're going to have today is something based on Torah and psychology that I picked up throughout the years of my own studying and learning to try to help others, a person who personifies the ideals is indeed Mordechai Rabbi Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I'd like to dedicate our words of Chizuk today, L'Yoli Nishmaso. Alfred P. Sloan is a name known in the halls of management experts. But all of us are affected by his patent, by his ideal, by his chab. In the early 1900s, Ford invented the automobile. He made the first commercially sold automobile, first the Model A, then the Model T. But Alfred P. Sloan decided that as fashion changes with the seasons and with the years, so can automobiles. And he decided that every year there should be a new model of automobile. And as the head of General Motors, he competed with Ford, and he's the first one that made new cars every single year. He made cars follow style. He invented the 1921, 1922, 1923 model. In many ways, to use Yeshiva Shel Lashonos, he turned the car from Yigachetza, something we use just for transportation, to defining the Davra, to defining who we are. And Alfred P. Sloan affected all of us because the car became not just a method of transportation, but a status symbol. And the concept of having something that you use just for a utilitarian purpose at a status symbol was something Sloan really invented, became sometimes known as Sloanism, as opposed to Fordism that was very basic. And Sloanism affects all of us, whether we get a new model iPhone, or new model Tyros, or anything in between. The fact that things have to be rated by years and have planned obsolescence is something invented by Sloan. Now, the reason that affected all of us is that as people that are conscious of what others think, it's natural for us to be affected by some aspect of consumerism, of what things look like to others, which means anything we buy, almost anything we're involved in, will not only be assessed by how it feels to me or if I need it, but by what others think. And in reality, this is a window to the way that we function in life. We often function based on what others think. In some ways, it's a great bracha. In other ways, it's a terrible klala. One of the most famous Rambams is the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Perek Vav of Hilchos Deos. The Rambam says, "Dark Mishal Adam, the very teva, the way that this broken made us, is that we're followed, we follow others. We're nimshach after the chabura." The Rambam tells us that you have to be very careful to pick the right chabura, and if you find the wrong chabura, unfortunately, then it can be a terrible calamity. If you can't find any positive chabura, go instead to the Rambam. If you have no choice, go to the Midbar. That's how important it is to choose your chabura. But the Rambam tells us it's the teva, this is who we are. The question is, why? Why is it that we're motivated to be so influenced by what other people think? Why is it that Sloanism affects us? Why is it that our whole teva is to follow the masses, follow others? There are several benefits we have to looking at our identity as being people that follow, that get along with others. Sometimes you can think of it with Halan Rashi Tevos, ICE. I-C-E. I is identity. We like knowing who we are. Often, we try to understand ourselves. Socrates said, an unexamined life is not worth living. We try to understand who we are, why we do things, what we like, what we dislike. But that's avodah kasha shebe miktash. It can be hard to understand ourselves. Hard to know, really, who we are. What we stand for, why we do things. What is our identity? In some ways, material possessions provide a great answer. I'm the guy that drives the Lexus. I'm the guy that's the greatest masmid. I'm the guy that's the greatest bucky. When we have ancillary things, something else that tells us who we are, it helps us readily identify ourselves. And those provide the identity that we all crave. I, identity. Another benefit is C, cohesion. Cohesion is something we strive for. We want to be part of peer groups. We try to find others that are like-minded, helps us feel as part of a sum instead of an individual. We like to be part of a group. Since we like to be part of a group, we can readily find the group that we're part of by seeing the way people dress, the way people think, what people do. So sometimes, if I'm dressing a certain way, if I'm thinking a certain way, if I'm doing something, it makes me feel close to a group. We want to be part of a group. So having social comparison helps us feel we're connected to a group, something we all strive for. And E is we can estimate our accomplishments. Think about it. If we live in a vacuum, if we live just with ourselves, we don't really know how we're doing in life. How are we doing religiously? How are we doing economically? How are we doing physically? I don't really know. But if I'm 20 years old and I'm 4 feet tall, and I see that someone else is taller, I know, maybe I should look into growth hormone. If I am someone who is 20 years old, and I barely know how to learn Gemara, and I see everyone else knows how to learn Gemara, maybe I should try to work on my skills for Gemara. If I'm 20 years old, and I have no plans for future after yeshiva, and everyone else does, I say, maybe I should try to work on plans for yeshiva. By looking at others, it gives us a way to figure out, how are we doing in life? Hacha b'mayestinon. How are we? So, in order to estimate accomplishments, to figure out how we should do, to assess ourselves, it's very easy to have space on the right, space on the left with people, that we cannot say, that's how this person's doing, that's how this person's doing. And the way we see others is the way that we can get feedback and how to estimate ourselves. So in many ways, there's a benefit to looking at others. It gives us a rubric, gives us a way to understand how we're accomplishing things. We can estimate our accomplishments. So three benefits that we can have to looking at others in ways that we can then use that to assess ourselves are, number one, is identity. Helps us define our identity. Things, whether they're material things, religious things, physical things, help us decide our identity. Number two, cohesion. We can identify with a peer group. Helps us feel part of a mass. Helps us feel happy that we're part of a greater sum. And number three, estimate accomplishments. We can understand where we are. Helps us figure out our place in life. Those are three benefits that we can have to why it is that we might have a netia to connect to others. Here are two other reasons too. One might say that a large part of mental health stems from the ability to say no. Often, we feel a need to please others. One might even say that people-pleasing is the cancer of mental health. It's very hard for us to stand up and be alone. We feel a need to please others when others ask us to do things, whether they're things that we want to do, things we don't want to do. We feel we need to placate others. It can be people in our families, people in our general groups, people in our shir, people in our community. It's a constant need. We can all relate to this idea. Sometimes we feel a tremendous need to placate others. But as many point out, it's important not to set yourself on fire so that others are warm. It's important to stand up for who we believe, who we are. But that's not so easy. If we had to look in general, one of the most serious mental health general issues is that we feel a need to please others. It's very hard to stand up for what we believe, who we are. And that's a reason sometimes that we feel a need to connect with the group. We feel the need to people please, please others. So aside from ICE, those first three reasons, the need to connect to others can sometimes come from the desire to please others. There's a fifth reason as well. Fifth reason that it is we can sometimes feel the need to connect to groups and see ourselves as part of a larger whole. Post-World War II, there was a tremendous bump in research trying to figure out how do people work. Some of it was based on the tragedies of World War II, and others were based on the refugees and even those that were in England that were war-torn, trying to understand how do families work, how do people work, how do people recover. And the next generation of discovery, right after that post-World War II bump in mental health, saw many different psychologists and psychiatrists that were trying to understand the human condition. One of the most famous ones was a person named John Bowlby. And John Bowlby, in the 60s and 70s, looked at families that were war-torn, families that were together during the war, looked at records, looked at the ways people functioned, and saw that there's a tremendous import to having families, specifically mother and child, together during the first few days, first few years, first few months, and first few years of life. And he developed what's called attachment theory. In the 60s and 70s, Bowlby developed attachment theory and talked about how important it is for a mother and child, or for families to be attached to each other. And in some ways, in the 70s, even 80s, attachment theory became on the shelf. It was a nice theory people studied, people looked at, people tried to understand. Then, more recently, I think within the past 20, 25 years, attachment theory had a resurgence. People took it and tried to understand how couples work. He took the words of Bowlby and his book called Attachment and Loss and other works that he wrote, and they understood that Bowlby wasn't only describing how families develop and how kids need their parents, but he also was able to portend that if kids didn't have their parents in the first years of life, often they would play out those things with spouses. And even if parents and children were connected together, often spouses disagree on what seems like petty things, but really desire connection to each other. The question that often spouses are really asking each other is, can I rely on you? Are you going to be there for me? And once they put attachment into couples and family dynamics, it took off. Now you can doodle anywhere you want. Attachment theory, it is a very current theory in how to deal with couples, how to deal with communities, how to deal with people, how to deal with loss, how to deal with people that connect with each other. We all want to be attached. And one might say that there's a myth. The myth is that we have, that anyone in the world has what's called secure attachment. We can really feel connected to each other. We're really able to be completely connected. Most of us feel, in some ways we're connected to others, but in some ways we still want things. And often, the desire to connect to a group stems from this theory called attachment. We want to connect to others. We want to replicate our family unit. We want to replicate groups. We want to feel safe. We want to feel secure. If spouses can't let it happen, then there's going to be tension in the marriage. If families don't let it happen, there's tension in the family. Not only that, if groups don't let it happen, there's tension in the groups. But we try to be attached. We try to be connected. So in summation, we're beginning with five reasons that it is that people would try to connect with each other. First of all, identity. Identity itself is important. Cohesion, connected to groups. We estimate our accomplishments, ICE. Also, we're born to be people pleasers. It's hard to say no to people. And we can't forget the influence of attachment theory, the desire we have to connect to others. So those might be reasons that we try to be part of groups. One might even say there are upsides. It's good to know where we are in life. Good to know how to navigate life. We can look at others to help assess where we are. The problem is there are downsides too. And as I'm talking, I'm sure you can think yourselves of downsides. In fact, I dare say that our Friedman, the reason that you asked me to speak about this is because we can be familiar with the upsides of why it is that people connect with others. We're also familiar with the downsides. We live in a world where social comparison, peer pressure are things that we can benefit from, but they're also very negative. Let's discuss some of the negative aspects of why it is that it's hard to use groups to assess ourselves. And although there might be some positive reasons we do it, there can be some negatives too. But before I say it, I'd love to hear from yourselves. What can be some reasons that the need to associate with the groups can be something which we can feel safe with, but also can be negative? Anyone want to volunteer? Why? Yes.
Very often, specifically the peer pressure, leads people to doing quite silly things.
Oh.
For example, this is just my opinion, specifically in regards to technology, people tend to be pressured into using technology that you do not own, but not only do you not own, the technology owns you.
Wow.
The operating system that you use sells all your information. The apps you use, sends it off to the government, and the Chinese government, and whatever else.
In the Yama, in the TikTok, today, Sunday, wow. Okay.
And that is quite harmful, right? Not only that, it requires people to actively go out of the way to prevent. You can't simply passively not sell your information to random advertisers. These days, you have to actively look for technology that you own.
Okay, Firefox, great. Okay, yay, great. Whoa, okay, that's great. And there's even more to add to what you're saying. But let's see. And who else wants to add some of the negative aspects of peer pressure, social comparison? Yes, please.
It's like a group that you're trying to cohere to could have values that don't necessarily align with your own.
Absolutely. So we feel in a tier, we want to be connected to the group, but the values can be different. Very well said. Yes.
I would say that in a place like Yeshiva HaTzion, you have a great group of guys, but sometimes, like, if you want to push yourself farther, right, and, like, you know, being too focused on mimicking everyone else means that just kind of like stay in this area of the average, and you never motivate yourself to push yourself.
Well said. Well said. You drown in the messes. Well said. Beautiful. Please.
That's following what Avi was saying. It could lead to you just feeling like you're part of a mass. You're just ordinary. You're just average. You don't. Sometimes if you kind of like isolate yourself, do things on your own, you feel like you're really aspiring, you're departing from the mass, you're really going on your extraordinary journey. But when you're just part of a group, you just feel, you feel ordinary, you feel
amazing. So Avi was saying more that it'll only push you to being average, but your point is also you feel like you're accomplishing more when you're doing, discovering life yourself.
Sure.
Beautiful. Please.
I think also the peer pressure, or I think it's just more not peer pressure, it has to be a trend. Certain tequilas out there, I'm not going to mention what city, you know, you know. We have to be exactly like this, not so, but like, you'd be more accepted. I learned the hard way. My parents, we live in Central Jersey.
I'm going to mention tequilas.
you know, creative are lovely people. You have to blend into them to be accepted.
Yes. For sure, for sure. Yeah, that's great. Okay. Yes, please.
And also your friends and people trying to like help you, like learning Gemara and stuff like that.
Yes. So in some ways, is that are you saying more of a negative or positive?
Both.
Both. Yeah, that's true. Very true. Yes, please.
I think also suppresses a person's ability to think for himself. We'll get used to the fact just listening and taking whatever everyone else says, and you won't actually develop his own ideas or his own beliefs.
You say it can be a crutch. It can be something that's helpful to propel us, but also it can be a crutch. Please.
If we were judging if what liability they're giving off and the perception that they want to radiate, you're never actually judging based on anything authentic. And it's just a circle where you're radiating whatever everyone else is radiating.
Wow. Right. So in some ways, butthole. Right? It's hard to really. Wow, great point. Yes.
Since making people happy and pleasing other people is a good thing in general, and like following the crowd and doing good things is also a good thing in general. So it's hard to draw the line exactly when everybody is wrong and when pleasing someone is not the good thing to do.
Wow, you're pointing out that. In theory, if Akhir Rabbi Mahatos was a bad thing, then we'd say, okay, it's negative. But since there are nuances both of positive and negative things, so it's harder to know where you put the gather. Where is it good and where is it bad? Well said. Any other thoughts before I tell you some of my thoughts? One of them I just want to point out also in terms of technology, depends on the specific subculture a person is part of, but we live in a world with unprecedented visibility. And we see both, we're seen and others are seen. I don't mean this by, let's say, by rogue governments, but which might be true too, but we're also seen by friends, by peers, and we're conscious of how we present ourselves. Not only that, we're unfortunately at the mercy of how others present themselves to us. The famous Zoom corner, the entire room's a mess, but on Zoom or FaceTime, then FaceTime, which is not really FaceTime, it's FaceTime used to mean something else, the real FaceTime. So if we are in that corner, that perspective of life skews the way others see us, the way we see others. And that's something which is very real. No matter how much one buys in or does not buy into social media, that's a very real fact of the way life is. So there definitely, it's a mixed blessing. This Rambam in Hilchos Deos that says that our teva is to be part of it. I used ice and then the idea of people-pleasing and attachment to explain maybe why it's our teva. But it's certainly not something which is so simple. There are definitely many downsides to it. So, let's add some more downsides in the way that I put down some thoughts before I heard what you're saying. Let's see, and in theory, there yesh b'chal masayim mana. The Bali Musar often points out that Chazal seem to call kavod as kavod ha-medume. In reality, all kavod is kavod ha-medume. Because, think about it. Let's say you have a rav comes into the room, and everyone stands up. So in reality, the only way it is that these people are giving the Rav kavod, that the fact that their standing up makes any impact to the Rav, is if he's machshir of those people. I mean, if those people are chashuv to him, then the fact that they're mechabid him is something which is important. If he's not machshir of the people at all, the fact that they stand up is no different than an ant standing up, which means it's a vicious cycle. Kavod is really kavod and meduma. It's not really kavod, because who's really more mechubot? the Rav, or whoever, a person that is getting kavod, if kavod goes to his head, is really giving other people the power to be mechabed him, which means really, he's mechabed them in order for them to be mechabed him. Which means that, in reality, if we're giving a social group the power to define us, that's really all kavod hamadumah, even if we feel there we're chashuv, we're at the top strata of our social standing. In reality, that's still going to be a situation where we're really making them more chashuv than us, so we can feel chashuv. Which is an interesting Mobius strip of kavod hamadumah. Likewise, if Socrates said an unexamined life is not worth living, then we're fooling ourselves by saying that we're examining our life if we define ourselves based on brands, or based on people, or based on friends, based on beliefs, based on religious ideals, based on social groups, because that's not really examining our life. That's really providing us with a ruse. It's a nice way to pretend we're examining our life. It's a nice way to think that we know who we are, we know what we stand for, we know what our ideals are, we know what our goals are, but in reality, that we're not examining our life, we're not thinking of our own goals, we're not thinking of our own beliefs, we're not thinking of our own ideals, we're just mimicking others, and therefore we're convincing ourselves that we're examining ourselves. In some way, it would be nicer if we at least owned up to the lie that we're not examining our lives, and then we would at least propel ourselves to examine our lives. But if we are part of a social group which is causing us to think we're examining our lives, in reality, we think we are, but we're not. So that makes it sometimes more confusing, because we think we're doing what we want to be doing. Just understanding who we are and what we stand for, but in reality, we're not doing that altogether. Also, like you were pointing out before, we can limit ourselves, but obviously that's what you were saying before, we can limit ourselves by others, and we not only strive for mediocrity, but our accomplishments can sometimes be a shell of who we are. Our accomplishments can sometimes be really just something that we do, although they might seem like they're motivated by the proper purpose. If part of the motivation is for others, not just that it's shelo shma, what that really means is that the accomplishments themselves are not the accomplishments that we want. Quite the accomplishments are only there because what they're doing is in order to placate others. That means that we're not allowing ourselves to accomplish in order to accomplish, we're only allowing ourselves to accomplish in order to be part of a group. Now you might say, at least we're accomplishing, but in reality, it does take away from the gravitas and the ability to accomplish the way we want. Not only does social acceptance distract us from figuring our own goals, our own ideals, but sometimes it can convince us that what we think are our own goals and ideals really are, when they're not. Meaning sometimes we can think that we're in a situation where we're trying to accomplish the ability to introspect, and we think we found goals, we think we found ideals, but in reality, they're only things that others tell us. Which means, not only, like I was saying before, are we convincing ourselves we're introspecting, we're actually doing the wrong thing. We're only focused on what others think, and in reality, we're convincing ourselves of certain goals that are not ours. Also, if part of the beauty of attachment theory is that we're attaching ourselves and trying to connect to others, which is a very powerful human need, but sometimes we can feel over-attached. I made a comment before that often there's a myth called secure attachment. All of us, I think all humanity, is what we call really insecurely attached. We all are wanting in attaching to others. We're wanting, sometimes some might say, it depends on how psychoanalytic you are. Psychoanalysis really focuses on the first few years of a person's life and their way the parents interact with them. And that sometimes looks at that mirror throughout life. Depends on how psychoanalytically you look at life. But in reality, attachment is a way that we look at our need to connect to others. We're always going to find ourselves wanting. So if we're always wanting in our need to attach to others, it's important to acknowledge our need to attach to others instead of just letting it control us. Let's imagine that all of us find a need. We have a need to connect to others. We all find a need to be able to connect to other people. So it's important to verbalize that, to understand how much my need is. And if I then see the need that I attach to others, then I can at least be aware, hey, I want to attach to others. If I let myself be taken by the tide of others and I don't acknowledge the need that I have, often it can overwhelm me. So some of the ideas that you're conveying are included in mine. In general, we're seeing the idea of peer pressure and social identity as something which on the one hand is very beneficial, can be beneficial, on the other can be very, very dangerous, and in some ways, blind. So what do we do? So Halacha Maisa, we talked about some of the negative aspects of social comparison. So how do we navigate this? What do we do? How do we overcome? We have, on the one hand, there's a basic human need to connect to others. And then you pointed out, and I just added, some of the reasons that this connection is bad. What do we do, Halacha Maisa? How do we navigate this tremendous need, desire to connect to others, where it can sometimes be positive or negative? How do we overcome it? I'd like to hear your thoughts. What do we do? Please.
Surround yourself with the best possible versions of friends that you want.
So you're saying in some ways, acknowledge the need we have to connect to others. But despite the fact that we acknowledge the need, we try to at least whittle out the negative influences and try to make it positive. That's the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos, in Perek Vav, says, surround yourself with positive people. Very beautiful idea. So we're embracing the need, but at least navigating it properly. Very powerful. What else, please?
So we make lots of a community. One of the conformity, like the important and valuable aspects of a community, but what really importantly is should retain some individual identity. And should it still retain some decision-making ability. Mm-hmm. So it should have, should decide which values are worth conforming to and which should be individual.
So how do you do that? How do you accomplish? How do you figure out? How do you navigate? How do you understand which values are important to accomplish? How do you accomplish that? I think it's a great point. Let's think more about that. Meaning you're pointing out, not only should you embrace the social aspect, but also try to use the social aspect on the one hand, and also the fact that who we are as individuals on the other hand. We still need to work on how to do that. That's great. Please.
I think Raphael's idea is correct. I think you just need to take some time each day to think about, okay, is what I did today what I want? Is it what I value?
So you're saying time for yourself. Time to think about yourself and think about your goals and who you are. Wow. Okay. Please.
To get some diversity of experience and thought, so spend time in different places with people, that lets you check one against the other.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, in order to accomplish the idea of understanding yourself, it might be the more experiences you have, sometimes the more you can accomplish. One might say it's like the American approach to college as opposed to the European approach to college, let's say. Liberal arts, maybe it's more experiences, theoretically. Depends on which college and when. But yes. Yes, please.
But I think every single person should make a real attempt to understand their own biases, to understand which ideas come from themselves, which ideas come from society as a whole, and in addition to try to understand societal biases in order to truly understand where their ideas originate.
So one might say what you're saying is that you should have a bias, but at least you should be a bias neman. A bias neman be Israel, at least you know what your biases are.
Everyone has biases.
Yes, great. Okay. Well said. Okay, well, please.
I think this kind of connects with a lot of people have said. Sort of work towards building kind of a strong enough sense of self-identity and of your own values that you can try to figure out when peer pressure might be motivating you towards something that you think it's valuable that it's motivating you towards, or whether it's something you'd rather avoid.
Fantastic. Wow. Wow. And it's a very, very powerful idea. Before we continue, any other, please, yes.
If I could suggest a caveat to what some people have been saying about introspecting every day, I think Rav Aharon said that it doesn't have to do it every single day, you can do it periodically. It doesn't have to be something that you're constantly challenging about yourself. Like maybe I'm following up after the crowd, and maybe I'm not thinking for myself. Maybe it's something you can, every year Rosh Hashanah, for example, just every year reassess, and does that be every single day?
You see, when the Ramchal says in the Sefer Sharim that again, Yom Ramoshim Bo Cheshbon, and you have to Yomashri for myself and Yifashri for myself, that's an idea, that's something which we need to do. The period of time depends. For some people, it's every night before you go to sleep, for some people, it's once a Rosh Chodesh, some people, once a year. But the concept of looking at introspection is important. The question is, what does this introspection mean? What does it mean? In some ways, it's easy to pay lip service to. And that's what does it really mean? So I think what you're saying is very much on target. One can never overestimate the importance of trying to understand our own values, goals, ideals, and dreams. To understand who we are. Now, that is such an easy thing to say. It sounds great, but it's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's easy to look ourselves in the mirror and describe ourselves, but it's hard to know, what are my dreams? Think about it. If I ask you right now, what are your goals? What are your dreams? Chances are, those very dreams, those goals, are influenced by your family, by your friends, by your yeshiva. And in many ways that's good. But sometimes the words, your own goals, your own dreams, your own values, is a hard thing to understand or to even ascertain. It's not bad, but it is one of the complex issues that we're talking about. What does it mean? What are your goals? What are your goals? So often a way to help us understand what our goals, dreams, ideals are, is to, yes, sit down. Sometimes it's with ourselves. Sometimes introspect. Sometimes it might be a nonsense word, to extrospect, to help others, and speak to others, speak to friends, speak to chaverim, speak to rabbeim, speak to therapists, to understand what are my goals, what are my dreams, what are my ideals. Ultimately, part of it might be to differentiate ourselves from our families, from our parents, from our friends, even from others that influence us positively, to understand who I am. But there's one word which can help us do that, and the word is why. First, sit down, think about some of your goals, your dreams, your ideals. Then ask yourself, why are those my goals, my ideals, my dreams? You don't even need to know the answer. But the journey towards better understanding the question itself is very helpful. Let's imagine if you ask a Ben Torah, any serious Ben Torah, what is your goal? I want to have tremendous ideas of Torah. I want to have a melus for Torah. So ask yourself, why? Now here, why does not mean l'tantir. Really? Why? But why? Why? People need to understand them. Why is that? Why is that a goal? Why is that a dream? And in some ways, it might be that the first answer you come up with is because that's what my Rebbe taught me, that's what it means to be Ben Torah. You might quote chapter and verse that talk about the mitzvahs of Talmud Torah. But on the other hand, it might be something which you can propel yourself to internalize as well. So yes, step one is think about what are some of your goals, your dreams, your ideals. Then ask yourself, why? And to paraphrase the Aaron you talked about, let's use the other way, it's something which is not necessarily periodic, it'd be something which is constant. Ask yourself over and over, why? Why am I doing this? Why do I want to do this? The goal is not even the answer. The goal is sometimes to perpetuate the question. Why? Even if the answer is because I want to join in with friends. Okay. But that is perhaps the quintessential exam in life. Ask yourself, why? Why am I doing what I'm doing? And the constant asking of why, trying to understand yourself, that leads to self-growth. It leads to us understanding who we are. And again, even if the answer is just I want to fit in, but it makes us aware of who we are, of why we are, of why we do what we do. So it's those twins. Number one, to figure out my values, my goals, my dreams, my ideals, and ask yourself why. It happens to be there's a bit of a difference between most of us in the room, me and some of us in the room and others of us in the room. We all struggle with identity, with peer identity, with who we are, with our identities in groups, and how we dress, and how we think, and how we identify and within the subculture and the sub-subculture. But there's something else too. Some believe that there are different stages in life. There are different conflicts that need to be resolved in each stage in life. The conflict of adolescence is the conflict around identity and connection to a group. This concept that we're talking about right now, gufa alzeh and udanim, this concept of who am I vis-a-vis myself, who am I vis-a-vis group, is the tension in adolescence, trying to figure out, how do I fit in? That's why stereotypically, adolescents often change their clothes radically, they change their hairstyles radically, they can understand, they can do things that might be considered by some as rebellious. It's not really, the point is not to rebellion, the point is to understand who they are and understand their identity. Which means that it's important to acknowledge that as a person is a ben yeshiva, in yeshiva, often this is the struggle that a person has. How do I define myself as an identity that's my own? And how do I see myself as part of a group? So often, it's not something you can resolve right away, but don't forget to ask yourselves why. Another aspect of trying to figure out our values, our goals, our dreams, and our ideals is to look towards the future. Who do I want to be? What do I want to be? Why do I want to be that? To look not just based on now, but it's a way to sort of trick our minds into understanding with clarity why I have these goals, why I have these dreams. There's a very powerful book. Stephen Covey wrote a book Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Perhaps some of you have read it. So in his book, he has a very sobering but very powerful way for a person to try to figure out their goals, dreams, and ideals. It's an extreme, but it drives home a point. He urges people to imagine what is going to be said at their levaya, at their funeral. Now, it's a hard thing for us to understand. Perhaps we can talk about it a different time. One of the major tensions of life is that death is all around us, but it's something we never think about. And those two extremes are perhaps one of the great struggles of humanity. But the concept of trying to figure out, after everything is said and done, what will they say about me? It's a way to try to understand, what are my goals? What are my ideals? What are my dreams? Who do I want to be? That's something most of us can't relate to in terms of time. Hopefully we should have a long and happy and healthy life. It's many years off. But it helps us understand what's important to me. What do I stand by? Who am I? What do I dream about? What do I want to do with my life? And perhaps that resonates with you. Perhaps you can try to think of something which might be a little bit more happy. But the concept of standing, looking back, looking 20 years, 30 years, 40 years down the road, what type of family do I want to build? Who do I want to be? What type of life do I want to have? These are real questions we can ask ourselves at this stage in life, but it's not only about the answers. It's about the journey. It's about the question. It helps us understand, what are my goals? What are my dreams? Who am I? What do I stand for? Another way to sometimes navigate the peer pressure, whether it's Alfred Pisson of wanting a new car, or sometimes being in base medrash too late, is perhaps best illustrated by a very common issue that exists in psychotherapy. Unfortunately, the Daf Yomi, for those that Daf Yomi Brown probably 80 days ago did Perek Yesh Nochlin about Yerusha. So unfortunately, as much as families stand by each other, when issues of Yerusha come up often, it breaks families apart. Unfortunately, one might say in a deeper psychological sense, one of the reasons family gets so torn apart by issues of Yerusha is because children always want their parents to demonstrate they love them. And at the end of life, what kids really want to see is they got a fair share, which proves their parents love them. Either way, that the concept of Yerusha, and people sometimes that have fights in Yerusha, can be a very, very caustic part of life for families. So there was someone that I was meeting with who was going through a very difficult Yerusha battle, and he really wanted to stand his ground. He wanted to be able to inherit the way things should be. We talked a lot about it, and we talked about some of these ideas about it, really about his parents' love, maybe about attachment, connection to his parents, or desire for connection to his parents. But one of the ideas that we discussed was that it's easier for him to be mevater if he looks at his goals. His goals might be, rather than get a certain amount of money from his family, to keep the connection to family. To be mevater because he wants to keep the connection to his siblings. He wants to be able to not have machlokas. In other words, he is playing a different game. Often in life, we can be in situations where we're asked to play a certain game. And we think, these are the rules, this is how I have to play. But in life sometimes, we can dance to the beat of a different drummer. We can play a different game. Some of his siblings actually did. They fought tooth and nail. First with the Din Torah, Rachman Otsan, and then with a Din in Erkel Shogayim, because they just couldn't resolve it. And they went tooth and nail, and they feel accomplished. They got what they wanted. He was Mavater. He lost thousands of dollars. But he felt he was playing a different game. It wasn't the game he was playing. For him, life wasn't about getting his fair share. Life was about values of family, values of connection, values of being able to keep beautiful memories and positive memories of his parents. He was playing a different game. This happens in many situations. Often, Rachman Otsan perhaps is something closer to home for people that are in divorce. Often in a divorced family, one of the spouses going through a divorce can hire lawyers and try to make mincemeat out of the other person. And often the question is the person going to fight? Or say, you know what? I am playing a different game. In our lives, we might not be in situations where it's going to be families being severed by divorce or by tragic situations of loss like at the end of life. But in life, all of us can keep the same motto. I am playing a different game. For me, the goal is not about trying to have the latest, the best, or trying to be the best in Ruchnius or in Tashmius. I want to be the best for myself. I'm simply playing a different game. Another idea to keep in mind is that the whole idea of social comparison in some ways can be a myth if we let it. Around 15 years ago in Stanford, they did a research study. They had undergraduate students recruit people that they saw on campus that they saw as the happiest people on campus. And they interviewed them. And they tried to understand, what makes you so happy? Why do you look so happy? And they found something amazing in these interviews. They interviewed their peers, and they asked them, who do you compare yourself most to? And many of the happiest people laughed. They said, compare ourselves to others? What do you mean? They didn't understand the question. They didn't compare themselves. Now, that's how the research was published. Obviously, we know that we can sometimes compare ourselves to others. As we said, there are some benefits to doing it. But the fundamental belief that we need to use comparison as something as a crutch is something which these people could obey. Yes, we can compare ourselves to others, but in other ways, the tremendous emphasis that we can put by nature in comparing ourselves to others mars our happiness. Sometimes we have, literally, Ezeho Ashir Hasameach Bechalto, your own Chalek, Kipshuto. Sometimes looking at ourselves and trying to not see ourselves as part of the entire world, but as a vacuum, can indeed make us feel Sameach Bechalto. Stanford proved it. These beautiful interviews prove that happiness often is contingent on not comparing ourselves altogether. Oh, not upwards comparison, not downwards comparison, but we're ourselves. And the last point to keep in mind as we think of the idea of comparison is that often at the root of trying to compare ourselves to others is an idea of taking. The Rambam, we talked about twice in Hilchos Deos, in Perek Vav. The first two halachos talk about navigating social pressure. The Rambam says you should pad your environment with people that are positive influences. You know what halacha gimel is in Perek Vav Hilchos Deos? Halacha gimel tells us the mitzvah min haTorah, says the Rambam, of v'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, of loving others. We have a rule in Yerodea that sometimes when you're doing Hagala, it's a discussion in the Rishonim, but the Rishonim quote, that I did a terrible mitzvah of Obala. When something is mafet, when it's giving out a treif b'liya, it's not balea. Often, the more we give to others, the more we try to give to others in our social groups, the more we give to others in general, in our peers, the more we take care of others, the more we feel good about ourselves, and the more we are going to be less impacted by social pressures. And we're accomplishing the Avodah Kamocha. So it's no coincidence the Rambam writes in the first two halachos how we are influenced by others, and then in Halacha Gimel writes the Avodah Kamocha, that indeed is an antidote. The way we can sometimes help ourselves not be Borea is by being Mitra, by giving out the Avas Abrios, by giving out Simchas Achaim, by taking care of others. The more we take care of others, the more we're taking care of ourselves. So as we discuss the concept of peer pressure, let's keep in mind peer pressure, social comparison, is something which exists within us throughout life. It's true in yeshiva, it's true beyond, it's true in the communities we live in, it's true in Ruchnius and in Gashmius. But it's something which we can navigate. It's interesting, often people quote that a proof text, perhaps to a value of peer pressure, is the Rambam Bavasra, second parak, Kina Sofrim, Tarba Chachma. So it's interesting, how often in the Shas is that quoted, I do not know of Shas, I don't know. I'm not one of those that say, I know of Shas, and therefore I can be socially compared to others. I do not know of Shas. But, to the best of my knowledge, it's only Gemara Mav Asra. Only one case, that's a case of two yeshivos. If you have one yeshiva in a community, another yeshiva is allowed to set itself up. It denies the normal rules that we would say of competition, because the Gemara says, by yeshivos, can I throw from Tarba Chachma? Chai Yisrael is going to indeed be better off, because they'll have better Rebbeim, they'll have better Mechanchim, better situations. It's telling you a din in Chosh Mishpat. That's not a din in Hilchos Deos. In fact, the Rashbats, the Tashbates from Tshuvas, one of the later Rishonim, has a parish to Maseches Avos, he points out that Kina Sofrim Tarba Chachma is not an ideal. It's a fact. But that also is Kina. Kina Sofrim is something which is considered the Midah of Kina. It's not ideal. Happens to be, it's Marbe Chachma. So we can have this in Ruchnius and Gashmius. We can look at others. The ways to help us ourselves be immune to social comparison often center on trying to figure out our own values, asking ourselves why, giving to others, trying to figure out our own identity, speaking to Rebbeim and friends and therapists to be able to understand who we are. We should be Zocha Bezv Hashem, that as we focus on the ability to understand ourselves, we emerge with greater self-understanding and know that the Rambam and Hilchos Deos can be a kala, can also be a tremendous bracha. We look at the community that we're in and use it to fortify ourselves, be the best of the Hashem that we can be.
Thank you.
Please.
Question.
Yes.
Thank you. That was wonderful. In yeshiva, there's a lot of positive peer pressure. As in, everyone is learning, so I'm going to go learn now. Because that's what everyone does. And everyone's coming to daven, I'm going to go daven now. That's what everybody does. How do I know how much of that is me and real, and how much of that is my peers? And the event that's not, what advice is there to make it real?
Friedman, that's a fantastic question. And I think, Shuvasa Batido, in reality, rather than make your question to a question, it's a statement. It's pashut, that it's not all me, and it's partly my peers, partly me. This is for sure. Partly, there's no way, it's an extreme statement. It's hard to say that anyone is completely getting up to daven shacharis just l'shem Hashem halavad. I don't mean anyone in the world. But that's the normal struggle of a human being, is that we have many influences that make us who we are. So it's something which, rather than, it's a statement. That is true. We are influenced by many things, and much of it is the power of social pressure, for sure, in a positive way. The question is, your question is such a great question, how do we keep it? How do we make sure to keep it? So I think the why question, to me, is very powerful. The why question is, okay, I believe that it's important to get up for Shacharis and be in Shacharis early, let's say, or be the last one in Beis Medrash, or to be able to Chazer over Shir and know it Baal Peh. Why? Why is that important to me? The more I can answer why, the more I can all of a sudden be Kone B'Shinui, instead of being something which is only something that I'm doing because of others and because I believe it, something that I understand why I believe it. The more I understand why I believe it, the more I can then understand it's going to have a Kiyum. Number two is, I think, the honesty. This, above all, to then unself be true. To understand that part of it is actually social pressure. And like you were saying before, surround yourself with people that are going to do that. Just know that indeed, positive is the part of it is the positive social pressure, and that's not going to leave. I want that. So there's two parts to it. Number one, to know why, but number two, to be able to understand that indeed, when I'm doing it, part of it is the social pressure, and I want to harness that power to help me l'tov rather than l'mutav. Any other questions? Please feel free to any other thoughts. Yes.
If it's hard for someone to learn Gemara, or let's say any type of Gemara, how should they push themselves to do Gemara?
It's a very, very good question. Maybe question number one to ask themselves, my favorite, is why? Why are they learning Gemara? Why is it important? Why do they think it's important? And the answer might be that's what they say in yeshiva. But then you have to know, okay. You have to know that's why, which means it's something which is important to doing yeshivas, and I have to try to figure out how I can navigate it. If a person finds it hard in general, perhaps it's helpful to ask those that are specifically trained in the yeshiva about how to navigate the humps and valleys of Gemara and harness their experience, their expertise in teaching it, and be able to use that to help one grow. Because it sounds like if people are such experts in yeshiva, that framework might be very helpful to help a person do that. Please.
Is Kinyan Sofrim purely a bad thing from a moral perspective?
So you're asking a great question. It really depends on what Kinyan Sofrim means. I was simplifying it. Sorry? Is Kinyan Sofrim purely a bad thing? So I was quoting only one opinion in the Rishonim. I was really going to the extreme. That's a skewed opinion number one. I mean, that's clearly not perspective of everyone, but I was using it to make a point. But also you're asking, even in general, is it purely a bad thing? So it depends really on how we understand Tinas Sofrim in general. What is Tinas Sofrim? So I was explaining only as a Dinah Chosh Mishpat, but one might look at it in a more broad way of understanding Tinas Sofrim is that there are two ways to use friends or to use peers. One way is to feel negative about myself. Oh, never. I'm not doing what I should be doing. Oy. Another way is, you know, I never realized, Taka, a person can sit for 3.5 hours in Mace Medrash, go out for coffee once, and then be there focusing the entire day. That's pretty impressive. I never saw such a thing. Tina Sofrim Tar B'Chachma. It's not Tina with a negative receptive, it's with a Sheifa. It's with a desire to grow. So instead of being trying to pull oneself in a negative way and trying to say, you know, I'm really not where I should be. That's negative. Because in general, the more we think negatively about ourselves, the more we are going to create feelings of ulcers within ourselves. Psychological ulcers, maybe even physical ulcers. But if we use Tina Sofrim as a way of saying, wow, Taka, unbelievable. Rabbi Gottlieb is an unbelievable darshan. Maybe I could be a darshan like Rabbi Gottlieb a little bit. Whoa. Rabbi Gottlieb can give a lodestar. Wow. Rabbi Gottlieb can be like Rabbi Gottlieb. That's very impressive. So that's not the Tina Sofrim. Oh, well, who am I? Nothing like Rabbi Gottlieb. But at least to say, oh, I see what I can do, and to motivate oneself in a positive way, then you're right. Tina Sofrim Tar B'Chachma is actually the way, perhaps, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would want it to be.
On that note,
okay. I wish to have HaTzlachas Bracha.
Thank you.
My pleasure.